James Mattis says, don't worry, we got everything covered.
Rest assured, there are actions underway to protect our elections or to expose any external efforts to influence the American public.
This is USA Radio News.
I'm Captain Obvious, and Hotels.com rewards me basically everywhere I stay. So why am I outside my beachfront suite, aimlessly leading a 40-guest conga through the streets of Myrtle Beach? Because Hotels.com lets me do me. And because once you start a conga, apparently it's impossible to stop. I have no idea where I'm leading these people. Hotels.com. You do you and get rewarded.
Walgreens has good news for anyone managing diabetes. We've got your back. That's right. Walgreens pharmacists are here to consult with you in person and answer any questions you may have about new and existing medications. You can even get free advice from our trusted experts day and night at Walgreens.com or the mobile app. Walgreens has all major brands of diabetes testing supplies like AccuCheck and Walgreens TrueMetrics. That's not just good news, it's great news. Stop by and talk to your Walgreens pharmacist today. Walgreens, trusted since 1901.
North Korea has transferred the remains of dozens of missing American soldiers to the United States. And USA Radio Network's Chris Barnes has the details.
The president confirms it while speaking outside the White House on Friday morning at an event that was primarily designed to announce some good economic numbers.
They're coming back to the United States.
The remains of 55 American soldiers lost in the Korean War six decades ago.
We have many others coming, but I want to thank Chairman Kim in front of the media for fulfilling a promise that he made to me.
An official repatriation ceremony is set for August 1st.
A Jordanian immigrant could face the death penalty after a Texas jury convicted him of killing his daughter's American husband and an Iranian woman's rights activist in what prosecutors described as an honor killing. Prosecutors said the immigrant was so mad when his daughter married a Christian and converted to Christianity, he orchestrated the killing of his son-in-law and daughter's close friend. This is USA Radio News.
Everyone loves liberty, so why are you letting other people tell you what's best for your health care? Exercise your freedom with Liberty Health Share. Liberty Health Share is a community of people who voluntarily share one another's medical costs. Members are able to take back the freedom to make their own decisions about their health care. Stop letting others tell you what to do. Call us at 855-58-LIBERTY for more information or check us out online at libertyhealthshare.org. That's libertyhealthshare.org.
A new report shows that children who took omega-3 supplements as part of a year-long study behaved better than a group of students who only received the placebo pill. The results revealed the children who took the omega-3 supplements showed less aggression, improved behavior, and the effects seemed to encourage less fighting and arguments between them and their parents. But what is the best way to actually find an omega-3 and take an omega-3 supplement? Well, Paul Greenberg is a writer for National Geographic and also an author. He talked about the best way to get omega-3s into your diet.
I always recommend food over supplements. So first off, I'd say have yourself a nice piece of sockeye salmon or a plate of mussels. But if you must take a supplement, I tend to recommend supplements that are not causing an environmental impact on the oceans.
As the calendar turns to August, many folks are looking for their final vacation of the year. Well, why not hit the great outdoors? Jen Stevenson is co-author of a new book titled The Camp Out Cookbook. She says when you go camping and you're cooking, things don't always have to turn out perfect.
I mean, we like to say that camp food does not need to turn out perfectly to be perfect, and it's true. It's just last week I went camping, and I cooked our cornbread, which I've made 100 times, and it burned. It burned something terrible, and nobody cared. It was still delicious. You're outdoors, you're with your family, or with your friends, and it's just fun. It should be fun. It should never feel like too much work, and it's okay if stuff burns. It's actually funny. It'll be a story later on.
For USA Radio News, I'm Tim Berg.
Don't fear technology. Use it, understand it, and embrace it. The mission of Tech Today is to demystify technology. I'm your host, Chris Bianco, principal of Blue Panther Business Partners. Every Tuesday morning from 10 to 11, we will cover new apps, buying advice, technology news, and answer your questions. Good day, and join me on Tech Today on Hunterdon Chamber Radio HotelsDotCom. Don't fear technology. Use it, understand it, and embrace it. The mission of Tech Today is to demystify technology. I'm your host, Chris Bianco, principal of Blue Panther Business Partners. Every Tuesday morning from 10 to 11, we will cover new apps, buying advice, technology news, and answer your questions. Good day, and join me on Tech Today on HuntertonChamberRadio.com.
Well, good afternoon. It's a few minutes after 4 o'clock on a, I don't know, what do I tell you about this day and the weather? I can tell you one thing, nobody left any spots for us to play, so I guess this is going to be a commercial-free or almost commercial-free hour. But I wanted to talk about the rain, and of course what the prediction was this afternoon is there was about a 30% chance of severe thunderstorms. Well, I hate to say there were thunderstorms because it depended where you were. I was in Pottersville and we had severe thunderstorms earlier this afternoon for at least a half an hour. Apparently near Round Valley, they had very brief thunderstorms. In fact, everything seemed to be dry within about an hour. So what's happening tonight? Well, let's at least tell you what they're telling us. There is a prediction, 70% chance of severe thunderstorms tonight. That's not a good prediction for the Balloon Festival, of course. Saturday, there is a slight chance of thunderstorms in the morning, then patchy fog. And possibly, I mean, the thunderstorm should be early. So if you're planning on going to the Balloon Festival, there could be a slight chance of showers between 9 and 3. And then, as I said, patchy fog in the morning before 9. So there's a question whether or not the balloons will go up, and if they do, whether you'll be able to see them. Otherwise, partly sunny, high near 85 degrees. Calm wind. Coming from the west around 6 p.m. in the afternoon. So as I said, chance of precipitation about 20%, but frankly, it's going to depend where you are. However, if you're going to the Balloon Festival, looks like the best day would be on Sunday because it's supposed to be partly sunny. Actually, it could be mostly sunny. High near 83 degrees, calm wind becoming northwest around 5 miles an hour in the afternoon. That sounds good for the ascension of the balloons, which I think is around 6 a.m. and then in the evening. I don't have anything in front of me to tell you exactly what it is, but it is fun to see all the balloons go up, and even if you're not there all day, if nothing else, there are places along Route 22 and some of the back roads where you can wait and watch. However, they do enforce parking, so be very careful because you don't want to be ticketed just to save a few dollars. So what's happening the rest of the week? As I said, Sunday night, partly cloudy, low of around 64 degrees. Monday, partly sunny, at least high near 84 degrees. Again, chance of showers on Monday night and thunderstorms between 9 and 3 a.m. So by Tuesday, again, we have another chance of showers and thunderstorms after 9 a.m. I hate to almost say this because the days where we think we're going to get rain or thunderstorms, there's been a lot of sun, and it's certainly difficult for people to plan the day to go down to the shore. The other thing is make sure if you're going to the shore that you check the weather because it's very different. I mean, it's different between Hunterdon County, Morris County, Warren County, Mercer County, and even within Hunterdon County, as I said, there were severe thunderstorms and rain, heavy rain, over near Pottersville. Again, tonight, since it's supposed to be nicer, there's a dinner over in Pottersville. I believe the It's for the fire department. They really have went to lunch there. It was a great lunch, fun thing to do. Tonight, I believe tonight, they're having roast beef dinner, and tomorrow night it'll be turkey. But, you know, let's always support our local fire companies because they do a lot for us. They really do. You know, taxes are high enough here without having to have paid fire departments. Not that there's anything wrong with it, but as long as we have these wonderful people who volunteer, let's support them when they need to have support, which is now. So that's in Pottersville. I would say right downtown Pottersville, but there's hardly a downtown in Pottersville. But it's right behind the bank, and, I mean, you'll find it. You'll see all the cars. But anyway, it was a fun lunch. I had lunch with my dentist, which is kind of unusual, but that was a fun time, and especially fun because she wasn't having to dig around in my mouth. So in any event, what's happening in the law? Well, maybe some of the more interesting things for many people is the latest on New Jersey's efforts to legalize marijuana. Whichever side of that coin you're on, that's among the many legislative issues under discussion at the State House. And, of course, there are everything from school funding formulas to budget spending to sports betting. But there were two bills, both focused on marijuana. And they have, you know, a lot of people scrambling as to how their passage of these laws, either one of them, would impact the community. So the first one is S-2702, and it was introduced by Scutari and Sweeney. That one's a massive 117-page bill, and that's the problem with these bills. It's very hard to wade through them, and frankly, I think a lot of time there's not enough scrutiny on them. Certainly, that happens in federal legislation, and there's been a recent inclusion of something in some federal legislation that I'm surprised anybody really read it or didn't have questions or would have passed the bill if they realized it was in it. But in any event, I don't want to start talking politics. I just want to tell you what's happening. So this bill legalizes the possession and personal use of marijuana for persons age 21 and over. It also creates the division of marijuana enforcement and a licensing structure. So it establishes a graduated tax rate on marijuana sales, and that's to be implemented over several years. It also outlines procedures for local governments to enact ordinances governing the time, place, and manner of sales of marijuana. It would set forth procedures for facilities to obtain licenses for the sale of medical and recreational marijuana, and permits expungement of marijuana convictions. Actually, the expungement of marijuana convictions might be of some of the greatest interest to people, especially young people who have a marijuana conviction on their record, and because if, in fact, they have a felony conviction on their record, it's very important to try to expunge that type of a conviction. Well, any type of a conviction, and sometimes it's not easy. But there's certainly many middle-aged people who would have possibly have a conviction, a marijuana conviction, and somehow it was a felony. Now, we'll have to find out once this legislation, if in fact it's passed, just what in fact and who would be entitled to even apply for expungement. Now, that's over and above regular expungement statutes, which, of course, there is a expungement statute that, you know, people can certainly apply now to expunge marijuana convictions. So the second bill, also, it's S-2703. It's also introduced by Scutari and Sweeney. And, in fact, it's dubbed the New Jersey Marijuana Legalization Act. It covers the same points as S-2702, the bill I just talked about, but it also expands access to medical marijuana. So under current law, medical marijuana usage in New Jersey is limited to those diagnosed with a, quote, debilitating medical condition. And under the proposed legislation, medical marijuana would be available to individuals diagnosed with, and this is, quote, qualifying medical condition as a treatment of first resort. So the list of qualifying medical conditions includes, among other illnesses, epilepsy, post-traumatic stress disorder, glaucoma, human immunodeficiency virus, acquired immune deficiency syndrome, cancer, multiple sclerosis, and multiple dystrophy. Now, you know, certainly I think there might be some question on, inclusion of some things because of the difficulty in diagnosing, for example, post-traumatic stress disorder. I know that certainly in California, it was unbelievably easy to get a prescription for medical marijuana. It really was. So there, and I absolutely believe that there are certain medical conditions that can be helped with medical marijuana. In fact, certainly some people suffering from cancer, it will lessen the pain. And again, I think if in fact it's going to be medical marijuana, however, they have to be very careful because it's frankly a joke in California. Whatever you think about it, whether it shouldn't just be limited to medical marijuana, that's one thing. But if you're going to limit it to helping medical conditions, then that's what it should be. And I take no, I'm not trying to sell my belief one way or the other, although I have to say it has changed over the years based on what I have seen happen to so many people who were heavy marijuana users. And I'm not saying that it has to go into other drugs, and I don't believe that it can be a gateway drug, but it doesn't necessarily have to be. But there are certain health conditions that, you know, I personally have seen people suffer, and probably because of heavy marijuana use. In any event, what the New Jersey Bar Association has done is create a cannabis committee to review the legislation and explore the legal issues surrounding cannabis, both from the business planning to the criminal matters. And, of course, marijuana has become big, big, big business in states like Colorado. And, these are not the mom and pops that we're used to. These are huge operations. So in any event, that is going to be something that will be in the news since the legislators continue to debate the topic. Apparently, there seem to be more questions than answers being generated outside the State House. Apparently, I think it was last week, if I recall, it was just last week that the Attorney General, Gubir Grewal, asked that municipal prosecutors in New Jersey seek adjournments. And I have more information on that, which I will talk about after this. And so that key questions, of course, center around which offenses would become eligible for expungement if marijuana were to become decriminalized, and other factors relative to expungement. Of course, in the employment area, questions include whether an employer could terminate an employee who tests positive for marijuana and the conflict that could exist between the state and federal laws. In the local government area, at least 28 municipalities in New Jersey have, in fact, passed measures to ban or strictly limit marijuana businesses within their borders. So questions will remain regarding how those bans will affect neighboring municipalities and the conflict between state legislation and these existing measures and other issues. Not simple in any event. But so the all eyes, certainly in the legal community, are on the legislature to act in September. And so as the state prepares for the onslaught of new regulations, everybody's going to be looking for this. And as I said, the Attorney General of New Jersey, Mr. Grewal, and I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly, sent a letter on July 24th to all county prosecutors and all county municipal prosecutor liaisons and all municipal prosecutors. And so this was regarding statewide guidance on charging marijuana-related offenses in municipal court. And this is what he said, and I'll read it because I think it is important. And so on, what he said is, on July 19th, 2018, the chief municipal prosecutor of the city of Jersey City issued a memorandum to his assistant municipal prosecutors titled, quote, New Marijuana Decriminalization Policy. And it was referred to as the Municipal Decriminalization Memorandum. And the next day, actually, the Attorney General concluded that the Municipal Decriminalization Memorandum was an improper exercise of a municipal prosecutor's authority, and he issued a letter pursuant to his supervisory authority of municipal prosecutors, and he has that authority pursuant to a law, which is New Jersey. You can find it at NJSA 2B:12-27. And so he, the Attorney General, rendered the memorandum void and without legal effect. So then the issuance and subsequent rescission of the Municipal Decriminalization Memorandum made clear that some municipal prosecutors would benefit from additional guidance about the scope of their discretionary authority. So this is why the Attorney General issued this letter. And he said this was particularly with regard to marijuana offenses. So to address this issue, the Attorney General said he plans on convening a working group of criminal justice stakeholders, including the Hudson County Prosecutor and the Chief Municipal Prosecutor of Jersey City. And they're going to study the issue and advise him on possible solutions. And he said that by the end of August, he intends to issue a statewide directive concerning the scope and appropriate use of prosecutorial discretion in marijuana-related offenses in municipal court. So in the interim, he asked that all municipal prosecutors in New Jersey seek an adjournment until September 4th or later of any matter involving a marijuana-related offense pending in the municipal courts. So what he's saying is not the defendants, but he's asking that the prosecutors ask for adjournments. And the reason he's giving is that the adjournment will give his office sufficient time to develop appropriate guidance for the prosecutors. And what he's saying also is that his request should not be construed in any way to create any substantive right that may be enforced by any third party. Not sure exactly what he means by that. But the point is, he's asking the prosecutors to seek adjournments. And somewhat reminds me back in the day, many, many years ago, when under the DWI statutes, there was an issue of when a breathalyzer was, in fact, administered. And so the argument back in the day was that if someone was picked up and charged with DUI, if they waited for over an hour to administer the breathalyzer, that the reading would be higher. And it was. I mean, if somebody is drinking, and what they would do is they would sit outside the bars, pull people over, and arrest them, take them back to the police station, and then have them sit and wait for about an hour. The assumption was they were just drinking when they left the bar, and if you wait for about an hour, their reading will be higher, and therefore they would be able to get a conviction for DWI. And of course, there was a separate and is a separate offense if you refuse to take the breathalyzer. But this was calculated to make sure that the reading was as high as possible. So at that point, a lot of defense attorneys were going into court, and they were bringing in experts who would extrapolate to show that when the person was arrested, that they would have been under the legal limit. And these prosecutions were fairly effective. Well, the case went up to the appellate courts, and a lot of people decided, instead of pleading out the cases, defense attorneys decided to wait, and because they thought for sure that the appellate division would, in fact, uphold the fact that you can't wait for a breathalyzer and then charge someone who probably was under the limit when they were picked up for DWI. But in fact, the appellate division said no. They did not go along, and so many people who had waited were in fact then convicted, even though they had been held for some period of time before they were actually tested. So this is somewhat similar in the fact that now probably I would think that many people would really like to get their cases downgraded or, you know, just plead out to a lesser charge to not take any risk here. But the prosecutors are the ones who are going in to ask for these cases to be held and seeking an adjournment until at least September 4th, 2018. It'll be interesting to see what happens if, in fact, a defendant doesn't want an adjournment and wants this case to be heard right now. And I'm sure that issue will come up on appeal in the future. So we're just at about the half of the hour. So just to stop talking for a few minutes, since I don't know who our sponsors are supposed to be, I guess I'll just play a few. And I'll play some of them from yesterday.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HuntertonChamberRadio.com. Brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
Are you struggling to find the right person to stay in a critical role in your company? Trying to attract and retain millennials? Retail Personnel is your staffing solution. Located in Lebanon, New Jersey, Regional Personnel is an ASA-certified, privately held staffing and recruiting firm providing you with everything from temporary to permanent employees. As ASA-certified professionals, we employ the latest tools and techniques to find, screen, and present to you the best talent that fits your needs. The result? Access to top talent in the shortest time with the lowest chance of turnover. We guarantee it. So call Regional today at 908-534-8113 or visit us on the web at regionalpersonnel.com.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, Hunterdon Chamber.
This is Tony Clark, para planner at Patton Heide & Associates. Americans believe they should be in charge of their own future, how they will live tomorrow. Since 1894, Ameriprise Financial has worked for their clients' futures, helping millions of Americans retire on their terms, when they want, where they want, doing what they want. Today, Pat and Heidi and Associates, a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., remains true to the vision of always putting clients first. We are ready to help you put a confident retirement more within reach. Put the strength of a leader in retirement planning to work for you through a personal one-to-one relationship. Pat and Heidi and Associates will work with you to develop a plan to help you pursue your retirement goals. Call
Advancing Hunterdon is an ever-sharp focus on the growth and prosperity of Hunterdon County's businesses. Advancing Hunterdon engages businesses within and throughout the county that are responsive to a call to action as the next chapter in business success. If your business and organization wants to get engaged, contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. Advancing Hunterdon, a roadmap for economic growth for the business community of Hunterdon.
I'm Andy Ross. I'm chairman of the Ambassadors Committee of the Chamber. As members of the Ambassadors Committee, we contact new and renewing members of the Chamber to get their feedback on their Chamber experience and make them feel more at home with the Chamber.
Hunterdon Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
¿Sabía que de cada 5 personas hay una que lucha con síntomas difíciles de salud mental? NAMI es una organización estatal sin fines de lucro. Somos empleados voluntarios. Somos la voz de la nación sobre las enfermedades mentales. NAMI te ofrece grupos de apoyo, educación e información. Nuestro programa educativo de Familia a Familia está dirigido por miembros de NAMI para familiares y amigos de personas que luchan con dificultad de salud mental. Llámanos al 888-803-3413. Recuerda, no estás solo. NAMI está contigo y no hay salud sin salud mental.
Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterdon Medical Center's Physician Referral Service at 1-800-511-4HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.
Well, we're back, and it's the law. I'm Pat Smits, and those of you who know me know that my practice here in Hunterdon and, frankly, all over the state is limited to family law cases, matrimonial, divorce. I do some international work, which is very interesting, and custody, etc. But I don't limit this program to family law, which would probably be even more boring than sometimes this program is. And I try to provide news on legal issues, and in fact, that's why I was talking about the proposed statutes with respect to legalizing marijuana. So what else is happening? Well, there was a very fun event last night, and Judge Bob Reed, many of you who know him, he's been a longtime person, lawyer around Hunterdon. Before he went on the bench, he was on the bench for 14 years. He is the presiding criminal judge in the vicinage, that's Hunterdon, Somerset, and Warren. He's done a terrific job of that. And why is he retiring? Well, he's retiring because under New Jersey statute, the judges must retire. There's a mandatory retirement age at 70. So we all know that Bob is going to be 70 on Monday. He will be coming back on recall. So what happens in New Jersey is a judge who retires at 70 can be called back on recall. Now, what does that mean? Does it mean they can get their retirement plus a salary? No, unless it's changed, what they do is they can come back part-time, and no matter how many hours they work, they can't be paid more than retirement plus what they earn, more than a sitting judge. So in other words, and I remember Judge Glickman years ago, I think he came back and he was working 4 days a week, and of course, at that point, I think it was about 25% was all he could receive because of his pension. So I'm not sure what it is right now, but happy retirement and welcome back to Judge Reed. If you know him, please reach out to him because he really is special. So then another issue with respect to the court is that justice received tenure. That was Justice Patterson. And on Thursday, the state Supreme Court approved her, Justice Ann Patterson, for tenure. Now, this means after 7 years, every judge in the state of New Jersey has to go up for reappointment. And if, in fact, they're reappointed, they have tenure until they're age 70. So this means, for example, when Judge Reed, after his seventh year, he went up for tenure and was appointed for another 7 years. And once they have tenure, they could only be removed for cause. And New Jersey, as I've said so many times, it's so important that we have here, we have judges who are appointed and not, in fact, elected. And the reason I'm hesitating a bit is Bill Wolfson has come in a little early, so I'm going to give him a chance to think about a few things, and maybe he will want to talk at all about something that's happening in bankruptcy. So right now, there have been some, in addition to the statute that I was talking about, there's been some cases approved. There was a Brewer Red Bank. This was a tax case approved versus RMC Meridian Health. And then there was another tax case, Bence versus Township of Little Harbor, Little Egg Harbor, that is. And those of you who know the difference, I don't. Those were two cases that were approved for publication this week. The other case, that was really a pretty important case. There was another medical malpractice case, and that was a case where the plaintiff appealed the appellate division's decision reversing the trial court directing the release of redacted version of an incident report drafted by the defendants. And so this was a Supreme Court decision written by Justice LaVecchia. And, of course, there aren't any, and I think Bill would tell me and agree, there don't seem to be any short opinions from the appellate division. This was a 53-page decision. And what happened in this case is that the plaintiff appeared at defendant's emergency room, was admitted, and underwent multiple surgeries. During her hospital stay, her physician noted in the record that plaintiff missed multiple doses of a prescribed antibiotic. And she later filed the present medical malpractice action against the defendants. And so what happened is when there are cases that are filed, there's what we call discovery. In other words, both sides get to find out a lot about what the other side has in support or opposition of the case. So in this case, during pretrial discovery, the plaintiff served interrogatories on the defendant. Interrogatories are written questions that have to be answered. And so she served these interrogatories on defendant hospital, seeking the names of any person aware of, and this was the quote, a statement regarding this lawsuit, end quote, and also wanted access to such statements. So what happened is the defendant hospital responded that there were two reports, but declined to produce them under the privilege of self-critical analysis. So what happens is many hospitals have what they call a procedure of self-critical analysis, and they do this in order to improve their hospital procedures. So in this case, they did not want to release this, and of course they would be saying, hey, look, if we have to release this type of self-critical analysis, we're going to stop doing it. We're not going to improve the health of all of the people in the future. So in any event, the plaintiff in that case moved to compel production of redacted versions of the reports. And then the trial court in that case ordered the release of a redacted version of one of the reports. The trial court agreed that it was the product of self-critical analysis, but found that it revealed plaintiff had suffered a, quote, serious preventable adverse event under the Patient Safety Act. So the case went up on appeal. The appellate division reversed, ruling that expert opinion was necessary to demonstrate the plaintiff's what occurred due to an error in care. So then this went up to the Supreme Court of New Jersey, and they affirmed the appellate division, ruling that the self-critical analysis privilege barred disclosure of the report. The court held that the self-analysis and that the patient only had conditioned the privilege on whether a hospital performed a self-critical analysis, not whether the report identified it as something that would be a statement. And the court further agreed that the court should not be determining whether a reportable event had occurred, and they vacated the appellate division's judgment on the standard for identifying a reportable event. However, they reversed the appellate division order to the extent that it terminated the defendant's discovery obligations, finding that the defendant still had unmet discovery duties. So this case went all the way up to the Supreme Court over issues of what a plaintiff in a medical malpractice suit can, in fact, obtain in discovery. So now I'm going to ask my friend Bill if he has anything that's come up in the bankruptcy court that might be interesting, because I have some criminal law cases, but since we don't have any listeners who commit crimes, and
well,
hopefully
don't know that, Pat.
And hopefully none that, I don't think we're being listened to in the Somerset County Jail, but who knows?
On the other stand, if you've been out to some fancy restaurant and you've seen some of those prices, maybe they are criminal. On the other hand, folks, good afternoon. I'm Bill Wolfson, and like my colleague Patricia Garrity Smith, I am a lawyer, and I want to talk to you about a very interesting case that came down from the U.S. Third Circuit Court of Appeals called Veltre, spelled V-E-L-T-R-A, and the adversary here was Fifth Third Bank. Now, the U.S. Third Circuit Court of Appeals is one step below the U.S. Supreme Court. For our listeners' benefit, who are non-lawyers or who have the benefit of not being married to one, the Third Circuit Court of Appeals is one of 11 judicial circuits that the United States is divided up into. And the Third Circuit is New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Delaware, and don't ask me why, the U.S. Virgin Islands. Great place if you're a circuit judge to be sent to get some sunshine, fresh air, enjoy the tropics, and make good rulings. But let's talk about Veltre. Veltre is a case that involves Pennsylvania law and the applicable of Pennsylvania law to foreclosure and foreclosure sales and its intersection with bankruptcy law. Now, in bankruptcy law, we have to look to bankruptcy. The bankruptcy courts are required by the U.S. Supreme Court to look to state law for property rights, and this is no exception. Mrs. Veltre appealed the dismissal of a lawsuit that she brought to avoid a sheriff's sale of her home to Fifth Third Bank as a preferential transfer under Bankruptcy Code Section 547. Now, what is a preferential transfer? A preference has many meanings in the English language. It's, well, I prefer chocolate ice cream to vanilla ice cream, and I prefer hot fudge sauce to caramel sauce. But what a preference really means in a bankruptcy setting is that somehow one creditor got more than another creditor should get. And in bankruptcy, the proposition is that all creditors should be treated equally, and sometimes when we represent creditors, we say equally badly. But this is a very interesting set of facts. Mrs. Veltre had a house over in Pennsylvania, and there were two mortgages on the house, one held by Capital One Bank and the second held by Fifth Third Bank. Capital One Bank started a foreclosure after Mrs. Veltre stopped making mortgage payments. And Capital One got to a foreclosure sale over in Pennsylvania. Fifth Third, in order to protect its second mortgage, bought the property at a sheriff sale for $90,000. And that was a sum of money equal to what Capital One was owed. So Capital One walked away happy and went and promptly deposited Fifth Third Bank's check. Fifth Third Bank, who had a second mortgage, was now the owner of Mrs. Veltre's house. Now, Mrs. Veltre made a mistake here. Months later, she files for a bankruptcy, and she starts a lawsuit in the bankruptcy court called an adversary proceeding, alleging that Fifth Third's purchase of the property was a preference, meaning they got more than they should have, and that they were like the big hog at the trough that wouldn't let any of her other creditors get some of the value out of her house. In making this allegation, she claimed that Fifth Third received a pre-bankruptcy windfall at the expense of her bankruptcy debtor estate, meaning her interest, and other creditors by purchasing the property for a sum well below its alleged market value. And we don't really know what the market value was because the decision doesn't tell it, but suffice it to say it was much more than $90,000. The bankruptcy judge listened to Mrs. Veltre's attorney's arguments and dismissed her action, and making a finding that a matter of law, a sale that is a result of a properly conducted, non-collusive, meaning an honest sheriff sale where there's real bidding, is not a preferential transfer under Bankruptcy Code Section 547. And her lawyers didn't like it, and by that time Mrs. Veltre had passed away, so the executors of her estate, looking to preserve some assets for themselves or for others, also didn't like it. So they took it to the U.S. District Court, which is one step above the bankruptcy courts and one step below the courts of appeal. She argued on appeal, or her lawyers did, because she was no longer among the living, that a non-conclusive, meaning an honest, good-faith sheriff sale, can be put aside or canceled as a preferential transfer under Bankruptcy Code Section 547. And the Third Circuit Court of Appeals decided that they disagreed with that position.
So what happened at the district court?
She lost. She lost to the district court.
And then it went up to the Third Circuit.
Right. The district court agreed with the bankruptcy court that it was not preferential and it was a valid sale. So now she's up in the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, and her lawyers are standing on the fifth or sixth floor at Market Street and Fifth Street in downtown Philadelphia, one of my favorite cities. And here's what they argued. They said that this is a preference, and it should be set aside because Fifth Third got the house. And they got a house for $90,000, and that house was really worth more. So the Court of Appeals began by focusing on what a preference was. And a preference is a transfer that enables a creditor to receive payment of a greater percentage of his or her claim against the debtor than they might have ordinarily received had the transfer not been made, had that specific creditor participated with all the other creditors in the distribution of assets in bankruptcy. To avoid a transfer under Bankruptcy Code 547, rather, you've got to establish that the transfer of the property would have received that particular creditor to have gotten more than that creditor would have gotten, in a hypothetical Chapter 7 bankruptcy liquidation without the transfer. In plain English, what it means is, Judge, put this property back in the hands of the person who originally owned it, who had to file bankruptcy, and let whoever is appointed as their bankruptcy trustee turn it into cash and then spread it around according to what the bankruptcy code says. Now, in order to complete this inquiry, the Third Circuit said that a bankruptcy judge has to construct their own hypothetical Chapter 7 case and determine what the creditor would have received if the case had proceeded under Chapter 7 without the preferential transfer, meaning pretend that the money goes, the value of what was transferred goes back into the pot, and then apply the bankruptcy code's rules for a Chapter 7 distribution, a pecking order of who gets what. And let's see whether this creditor got more than Mrs. Veltri's attorney say that First Third Bank should have got. And that was exactly Ms. Veltri's argument, or her estate's argument. She maintained the sheriff's sale was an avoidable preference because it allowed Fifth Third Bank to get more than they would have gotten in a liquidation. As the Supreme Court of the United States noted in a case called BFP versus Resolution Trust, the bankruptcy code is really ambiguous about the value of a foreclosed property's value. However, under Pennsylvania law, which is similar to New Jersey law in this respect, everybody presumes that the price received at a duly advertised public sale is the highest and best price obtainable, meaning an auction. We know that if it was listed for sale by a real estate broker or advertised, you might have gotten more money, but this is a public sale, and people come and bid because, in effect, what the sheriff is doing is what a judge has ordered him to do, is to have a quick, effective, and dirty sale. Maybe not dirty in the sense of dishonest, but dirty in the sense that it happens quickly. It may not be the prettiest thing in the world, but it gets the property sold.
Well, Bill, let me ask you something then. How does a sheriff's sale work here in New Jersey?
Well, that's a good question. I'll circle back to that after I finish with this case. Thank you, Pat. The district court found correctly, according to the circuit, that the $90,000 obtained for the property at the sheriff's sale was as much as, if not more than, a Chapter 7 bankruptcy trustee might have gotten if he sold the property in hypothetical Chapter 7 liquidation. Pardon me. Put it another way, Fifth Third Bank got $90,000 for a property worth roughly the same amount in Pennsylvania law. As such, Fifth Third Bank could not have received more by purchasing the property at a sheriff's sale than it would have gotten in a hypothetical liquidation. Thus, Ms. Veltri's estate lawyer's arguments failed, and the Third Circuit affirmed the district court. So, as one of my favorite childhood heroes, Soupy Sales, would have said, what do we mean by that? Well, it's very interesting. Remember, Fifth Third Bank had a second mortgage, and Fifth Third Bank paid $90,000 to the mortgage that was ahead of it at the auction when they began bidding, when they bid. And what happened was they now owned the property, and they managed to save whatever the value was that Mrs. Veltri owed but didn't pay them. But wait a minute.
If this was a second mortgage,
Yes. They
would take the property subject to the first mortgage, correct?
No. The first mortgage has gotten $90,000.
Oh, the first mortgage got the 90.
And it got the 90.
And that's what the first mortgagee was owed, was 90.
The case doesn't say that, but if they were owed 100, well, and they let it go for 90, it was because they were willing to walk away from a $10,000 that they were owed.
So are you saying that, let's assume that the first mortgage was, let's say, $100,000. Are you saying that unless the first mortgagee bids up $100,000, that they're only going to get what is bid?
They're only, usually a first mortgagee credit bids. they bid the amount that they're owed, that
right.
$100,000.
But what happened in this case?
In this case, it's not clear from the opinion what happened, but it sounds, and we don't know what the property was really worth if it were given to a real estate broker and exposed for sale. We don't know what the amount was that Capital One Bank was owed on its first mortgage. But we do know that Capital One Bank may very well have only been owed that $90,000 because otherwise they would have bid for the property and gotten it, but then they would have had the headache of fixing it up and selling it and hoping for the best, hoping some buyer would come along and want it. So here you have Fifth Third Bank ready to jump in to protect its second mortgage, and we don't know what that amount was. And we also don't know what the property value was, and the Third Circuit didn't have to reach those issues because they weren't raised either in the bankruptcy court, perhaps, and they weren't also raised in the U.S. District Court, which serves as the first level of appeal for bankruptcy courts.
But I think what most people would be interested in, as I am, is if Capital One, who was the first mortgagee, correct?
Mm-hmm.
If they... Right. Didn't bid on the property. Let's for some reason. If they didn't bid on the property, the person who bids, are you saying they wipe out the first mortgage?
No.
Or they take it subject to the first mortgage?
They would take it subject to the first mortgage.
Well, that was my question.
Yeah.
Whether or not.
Now,
so let's assume that the bid was $90,000 and Third Bank. If Capital One had a $150,000 mortgage, then isn't it true that Third Bank would be taking, paying $90,000, but still subject to at least a portion of the $150,000? Wouldn't they be?
I'm going to take back what I just said because what I told you was a mistake. Forgive me. If Capital One, the first mortgage holder, was owed $120,000, let's say.
Right.
But they were willing to let it go for $90,000. They're walking away from the other $30,000, and First Third Bank, having paid $90,000, would own the property free and clear of Capital One's interest. So let me correct that. That's the way foreclosure works in New Jersey, and I believe that's probably also the way it works in Pennsylvania. We both have sheriffs conducting sales, and there's both bidding, because the philosophy in the law is that if you expose the property to an auction and people come who want the property, they're willing to compete and get into a bidding war over what the property is worth. Now, I've attended sheriff sales. I've bid at them for clients, most recently up in Warren County about a month and a half ago. And what happened was that I was given bidding instructions. And for a certain property, I was not to bid more than $75,000 because that's what my client, who is a real estate developer who buys properties, fixes them up, and puts them back on the market to sell, felt that that would be appropriate for his company to... after his company had put the money into it to fix it up and sell it and perhaps pay commissions. That's what he was willing to pay to make this profitable for them so that they would make some money. And that's their business. They know the business very well. They know their construction costs. They know the towns. They know the ability to get a piece of property sold, and they have a real estate sales arm as well. So what happens is very interesting. They sent me to the sale, and I forget the name of the bank that was auctioning the property, but the bid, for some reason, opened at 60. So I stood up and said $60,250. And the representative of the bank said $65,000. And then some other bidder got up, and she said 66. And I said 67, and the bank said 70, and I kept my mouth shut. And finally, the bank bid in the rest of its lien, which was about $100,000, and they became the owner of the property. And I took my client's cashier's check and put them back in my briefcase and called the client and said, "We didn't get that one, and here's what happened." And the client said, You know, the bank will be stuck with it for a long time. Now, what happens after a bank gets a property back? They've gotten the people out, or maybe the people have already left. What happens? Well, they've got to find somebody who wants to buy it. And in order to find somebody who wants to buy it, who's not a builder or developer, or got somebody who rehabs, we see a lot of couples who, husbands and wives, or boyfriends and girlfriends, who are now getting into the rehab and property acquisition business. It can be profitable, but there's a lot of risk. Because when you buy as is, where is, with all faults. And who knows what you're really going to get? Are we running out of time, Pat?
We're about running out of time, but another question. So